Well, now for this week's Open Country, Eleanor Goodman sets off in search of the good life in the Chilterns.
This train will be stopping at Beaconscroft Town, Hanton, and Evelyn.
I'm looking down on a village from a great height. It's just outside Beaconsfield in the Chilterns, and it's the very model of an idealised English village. There's a pub, a blacksmith, a station, and a cricket green in the middle. In fact, that's precisely what it is, Beaconscroft Model Village. No building is more than 3 foot high, and the figures playing cricket are about 4 inches high. But according to a survey produced by the Halifax, even today the Chilterns represent the rural idyll, the best place to live in rural Britain. I'm here to discover whether it just offers a fantasy version of rural life for those who can afford it, like the pop stars who have vast houses outside Beaconsfield, often protected by electronic gates, or whether it's a landscape with much to offer both those who live here and the millions who visit it. I'm now in the village of Chalfont St Giles, and it's just about as immaculate as the Beaconsfield model village, because it's got a little village green with a pond beside it, some beamed houses with wisteria growing outside them. It's got a good scattering of shops, and of course it's got a pub plumb in the centre of it. And it's all those things, coupled with its location in the Chilterns with these wonderful woods nearby and a field sweeping down right into the centre of the village, which according to one survey makes it the most desirable place to live in Britain. According to another survey, the Chilterns as a whole is the most desirable rural place to live in Britain. So I've come here to meet John Taylor, chairman of the Chiltern Society, to discover what it is that makes the Chilterns so attractive and whether or not it's a good thing to be labelled as the most attractive place to live in rural Britain.
Well, it might be very satisfactory at the moment, but I think it does put added pressure on in the future in terms of more people coming to live here would add to the pressures of the development and pressures on the environment, which everybody at the moment is attracted to. I have to say we have about, and this is government information, it's about 50 million visits a year are made to the Chilterns on a daily basis. So it's a well-visited area, and a lot of people come from within 20 miles travelling, so it's open country to people around about.
You moved here yourself 55 years ago and you came from London, and
yes,
there's presumably a constant flow of people moving from London or would like to move from London. Do you think this area can accommodate more people, or do you think it's got as many as it can take?
Well, I think the development pressures at the moment are very hard on here, and I think that the planners are trying their hardest to spread the development around the outside rather than inside the Chiltern. So we do have plans to add considerable houses, say, to Aylesbury and Buckinghamshire, but not within the Chiltern district.
But shouldn't people who are less well off be able to live in an area like this? Otherwise, doesn't it just become a ghetto for the better off?
Well, I think that there is social housing in the district as well, but if people say it's a nice area to live in, then that's because there are nice houses here.
I'm now sitting on a wall outside a house to let with Peter Scott, who's director of the Brampton Partnership and an independent estate agent. Now, it's to let, this house, rather than for sale. Is that a sign of the times?
I think it is, yes. We try to sell it, let me see now, for a couple of months and just weren't getting what the vendor expected, so it's quite common in this market for people to think about letting instead.
What are we talking about prices round here? I mean, if I wanted to have, say, a three-bedroom non-estate house round here with a bit of character, what are we talking about? How much would it cost?
Probably upwards of half a million.
Half a million for a three-bedroom?
Well, if you want the character cottage, something detached, own drive, garage, yeah, you would expect to pay that.
I mean, what happens if you're a local person who is, say, your carer or something like that? What would you do for housing around here?
Well, properties do actually start in Chalfont St Giles at around 160, 170.
There aren't many of those cheap ones, I bet.
Not many.
What is it that makes it so desirable?
Well, having lived here pretty well all my life, I think you've only got to come to a village like Chalfont St Giles, and it's very impressive as you drive down the hill into the village green. It's proximity to London, you can be in London in half an hour, and you are really in rolling countryside. I think that the schooling plays a major part.
Because you've still got grammar schools around.
We have grammar schools. There are bus services picking the children up at 7:45 in the morning, whisking them off to Dr. Chandler's and places like that, which are only 15 minutes away.
And they don't mind the roads and the traffic noise and the plane noise.
Well, the helicopter just going off is probably going to Chequers, I would say, which is just not far off up the road. We seem to have a lot of helicopters coming over Chalfont St Giles, and most of them end
up
at Chequers.
So you're saying it's all Gordon Brown's fault?
I would not want to comment on that.
I'm now sitting in a very attractive cottage garden, looking over a hedge of lavender onto a rather traditional border, and I'm with Alison Doggett, who is head of geography at a local school, and who has written a history of the landscape of the Chilterns. Now, looking out over this landscape, I wouldn't think it's changed that much, has it?
Over a short time, probably not. It's very, very rural here. We still have lots of the traditional Chiltern landscapes. We've got hedgerows, we've got woodland, we've got little odd-shaped fields, and it probably doesn't look terribly different from perhaps it might have done 100 years ago.
But the villages are very different in terms of the kind of people who live in them, aren't they?
Yes, the villages are totally different because most of the Chilterns now has people who are moving in, people who are commuting and living in the Chilterns but working elsewhere. So our rural landscape has changed completely and it's now a much more urban-based set of people who are living here.
It's because I was slightly sceptical because this Halifax survey evidently said it was the best rural place to live in Britain. Well, I'm not sure I'd really call it rural, is it? It's certainly very green, but is it rural in according to other definitions, would you say?
I think that the whole rurality issue has altered a lot in recent years, and the Chilterns is very much rural-urban fringe. There are parts of the Chilterns which are very traditionally rural. You can go down tiny lanes and go to some very remote places in the Chilterns. But much of it is rural-urban fringe, and that's the area really in the country, not only in the Chilterns, that's changing the most. And there is this big blurring of the boundaries between urban areas and really rural and remote areas.
Presumably a buffer is the Green Belt.
Yes, and the Green Belt is an area that is under a tremendous amount of threat, and there's a lot of talk about building on the Green Belt. Much of the land on the Green Belt is becoming quite degraded now. If you're having a bypass, it tends to go through the rural urban fringe. If you're going to build an industrial park, that would happen on the rural urban fringe. Even sewage works and cemeteries and crematoriums, all of those sort of things that don't fit into traditional urban areas, will be pushed out onto the rural urban fringe.
And has that happened in the Chilterns?
Yes, it's happened everywhere, and it's happened in the Chilterns too. So our Green Belt is quite a threatened area, and there's a lot of controversy about it. In some ways, the new thinking is that perhaps you ought to allow a certain amount of building on the Green Belt and protect the really important areas. Let the degraded areas, the brownfield sites as they're called, go, but keep the more rural, the more important rural areas. Because otherwise what happens is that the development, particularly housing development, jumps over the Green Belt, it leapfrogs it, and then affects the villages that were traditionally more rural on the other side.
On the other hand, you presumably do need some new development in these villages, otherwise they kind of fossilise.
Yes, and it's one of the things that's always happened in the Chilterns. We have a long tradition of absorbing new housing quite well because of the nature of the Chilterns, with lots of hills and little valleys and plenty of woods. You can actually absorb quite a lot of new building.
Chalk streams are very much a feature of the Chilterns landscape, and I'm standing on a footbridge over the Misbourne. It's a lovely bubbling brook between narrow banks bordered with flowers. But it must once have been much bigger because we're standing beside a mill which once had a big wheel on it. Now it's a very smart residential house. And to talk about this river, I'm joined by John Norris and Roger Lerry, who are members of the CS Rivers and Wetland Conservation Group. You can probably hear above us the planes stacking to go into Heathrow, I presume it is?
It's mostly Heathrow.
It's a reminder of how near to London we are. Does that put pressures on this river?
Well, indeed it does, because the abstraction's been so phenomenal in the past that the river disappeared. But some redress has been made, and there isn't so much abstraction now, and pretty well from the source down to nearly St Giles, I'd say the flow is as good as we can expect.
How characteristic is it of the Chilterns to have rivers like this? Are there many other little burbling streams around this area?
There are about 10 major chalk streams within the Chilterns. By and large, in chalk country, you don't have a lot of watercourses, and these 10 streams have very few tributaries. So they are precious to us. Globally, chalk streams are rare and threatened. We know there are some in Russia, there are some in New Zealand, but the vast majority of the world's chalk streams are in England and the immediately adjacent parts of the continent, France and Belgium, for instance.
But when you talk about its leaking and leakage, surely that is a natural process. That's nothing to do with mankind having taken too much water from it.
Ever since Neolithic man came to this country, people have been using the river. And that is why people are here in the first place. Mm. So they have used it by making mills, weirs, fish ponds.
Roger Leary.
A long time ago, the river would have flowed at the bottom of the valley, but it's been taken away from its good old bed and put up higher so that you've got a head to drive the mill wheels. Now, in the past, if there'd been a leaky bed to the river, the miller would have gone along there and fixed it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to do his work. So once you've got this interference, you've got to keep it going, because otherwise you've got no water. And the miller needed it for his mill in the past, and we need it now for the environment and for us to look at and think how pretty it is.
So what you're saying is this lovely stream going along here beneath me, it hasn't actually been going along this course?
No, it's man-made.
It doesn't look man-made, it looks so wonderfully natural,
well,
doesn't
it? It's been there for a few years, of course, but that's man-made. And this river, the leaky part by the pump house at St Giles, you can see where the bottom of the valley is, and this is halfway up. And it's very, very spongy stuff, almost like peat. And it isn't the original stuff. So, obviously, in the past, it must have had to be maintained for the mill in St Giles. And as I say, once you start interfering, you've got to keep going or restore it completely.
OK, well, let's go down and see what's happened down at Chalfont St Giles then. So we're standing on a wonderful slab of stone. It's about 8 feet across. But underneath it, in what used to be the riverbed, and now it's just basically a mass of dandelions. So how long ago did the river last flow along here?
June 2005 it last flowed, so that's just over 3 years it's been dry. And the way things are going, I don't expect to see anything here until next spring, probably.
Why does it matter?
Well, you ask the local people here, they will tell you why it matters. People in the Chilterns generally are very concerned about their rivers. They value them greatly. And when the river runs dry, people quite commonly say, oh, it doesn't seem the same today, you know. The river should be running.
We've driven across Buckinghamshire now. We drove out of Chalfont St Giles past some absolutely huge houses with electronic gates surrounded by pony paddocks, then up into the hills, which are covered with beech woods, and you've got these wonderful shafts of dappled sunlight coming through them. Then on to the M40, one of several motorways which roar through this area, and past High Wycombe, which used to be the centre for the furniture industry, partly because it was so close to all these magnificent beech trees. And I've met up with John Norris, who is from the Chiltern Woodlands Project, which is partly funded by the Chiltern Society. Just passing some kids who are blackberrying. Looks like they're going to find some. And we're going now into a dark beech wood. So how important economically have these beech woods been to this area, John?
They've been very important. Historically, they were the fuel source for London, and they supplied firewood from the medieval times down the River Thames into London. And then when that was replaced by coal, the trees started to be used for furniture making, particularly chair making. And the chairs were known as Windsor chairs because they were sent down the river from a Windsor direction, but they're actually made here in the Chilterns.
Is that a red kite I just heard above
that
us?
That was the red kite calling, yes.
It's not going to do it on cue,
no,
is it?
I've got a pigeon now.
But the red kites, you actually introduced them here, or...?
They were reintroduced about 20 years ago into the Chilterns by English Nature at that time, in partnership with others, and they've very successful reintroduction programme. They've now increased enormously in numbers, so there are probably a few thousand that actually fly across the Chilterns these days.
And you can see them with the tails, which give them their names, those kite-like tails. That's the way you tell them from a buzzard, isn't it?
Yes,
that one's got a pronged fork tail, and a buzzard hasn't.
The buzzard has the rounded tail.
Well, we've only gone about, 30 yards into this wood, and it's already surrounding us completely, isn't it? It's a wonderful feeling walking through a wood like this, because you're completely away from the traffic. It sort of insulates you against the sounds of the motorway.
One of the things it's done, and the temperature's actually dropped as we've come into the shade of the trees, and I think if the climate does become hotter in the summers, then people are actually going to enjoy the cooling shade of the woodlands more in the future.
And do you have bluebells here in the spring?
Yes, bottom wood is actually quite a good bluebell woodland in the valley bottom where there's enough moisture, and that is a real symbol of the woods of the Chilterns, are the bluebells.
And are these trees threatened, or can we rest assured that they'll be here in another 300 years?
Beech trees possibly threatened by a changing climate. They're likely to become a little bit more restricted into the soils they'll actually grow on. I think there's a good chance they will grow, but one of our biggest threats now to the quality of the trees we're growing is the introduced grey squirrel, which strips the bark off the young trees and kills many of them.
Do you have muntjacs around here? Are they another problem?
Muntjac deer, fallow deer, roe deer, they're all increasing in the area and they all like to eat young trees.
That root looks as if something's been eating it.
Yes, the bark has been stripped off by grey squirrels that feed on the sugary sap on the tree, and this is a mature beech that has had the root plate attacked. They will also find the strips of bark from the branches that have been stripped off the tree. So the major cause of the branches dropping out of these trees is in fact squirrels taking the bark off them.
How old are these trees? Because they are very, very tall.
These trees are probably a little over 100 years old, maybe 120, something of that sort. These are trees that weren't felled during the war, probably because they're too small at that time. So a lot of the mature beech woods in the Chilterns were actually cut down at that period, and these ones were presumably a bit younger.
So how tall are they? I always find it so difficult to judge. About,
I should think 80 or 90 foot, some of these trees. They're really quite tall specimens.
So are they due for the chop, quite literally?
They were marked for thinning maybe 10 or 15 years ago, but no work actually took place because the market's been so depressed for the last 10 years or so.
So they are a bit spindly, aren't they?
Yes, the idea of a lot of these woodlands is to gradually thin out the trees and give the other trees a bit more space, and that lets light in so young trees can grow. At the moment, it's a very even-aged woodland because of the lack of light. Letting patches of light in by felling allows the next generation of trees to start growing again. That was a buzzard.
How do you tell the difference between a buzzard and a red kite from their cry?
They are similar in a way. The buzzard is more of a mewing and the kite is more of a whistling sort of noise, but they're similar sort of sound in a way.
We've now got to a sign, Bottom Wood Nature Reserve. Picture there, I live here, with a picture of a dormouse, one hibernating one on a branch. An edible dormouse.
Yes, the dormice are one of the specialities of this particular woodland.
How do you know they're edible other than by eating them?
The Romans used to eat them by fastening them up in a clay pot, and yes, that's how they found out they were good to eat. So this is an area that was planted in 1951 by scouts, so we've got Scots pine and larch.
Apple tree, is that?
Yes, there's lots of crab apples here. We think the reason for that is when the scouts were planting the trees, they must have had lots of apples to eat, and we've got a wide variety of apple trees that have come up.
I must say, it's quite encouraging when you think this wood then is only, 60 years old, in terms of people who are planting community forests and things, that if you get something as wild as that.
Elsewhere, I planted some new woodlands about 10 years ago, and even those trees are now starting to feel like a proper woodland. You don't need really large trees to make it feel like a wood, and a lot of species will benefit in the meantime. Here we see a lot of grasshoppers and crickets just in this open glade, and you can see the wide range of wildflowers, which on a sunny day should be very good for butterflies.
So I can see scabious, I can see... What else should I be able to see by my eyes?
Marjoram.
Ragwort.
There's a whole range of chalk grass and flowers on here. Hopefully not too much ragwort, just one or two plants. We'll pull most of them up. Some of the other yellow flowers are Sir John's wort, which is quite a nice plant.
If I chew that, I would become immediately undepressed. But actually, I think wouldn't feel depressed if I was sitting on that seat up there in this glade, looking out over the wood. I think it's very good for your spirits, this wood.
Toot Hill, the toot part of the word means lookout. It's a Saxon word for lookout.
I assume it was because of the owls.
No, it's all to do with the viewpoints. We're just crossing a woodland boundary bank here, which is a division going back hundreds of years, showing where the woodland edge used to be.
And we're crunching our way over all these empty beechnut shells. Quite a different sound, quite a different feel to the leaves.
Here's one of the saw pits.
What's a saw pit?
It is an oval hole that was dug for cutting timbers. In the past, before they had power tools, they used to have a two-man saw with a top dog and an underdog working in one of these pits. They're always parallel to the contour and about 4 or 5 metres long by a couple of metres wide.
To look at, it looks like an empty pond.
Everything's been dug out has been put on the downhill side, and that would have made a level area where you could build a wooden frame up to actually then cut the log that you wanted to cut into a building timber or something of that sort.
You think that's where the phrase underdog came from?
Yes, the underdog had the dirty job in the bottom of the pit, getting all the sawdust rained on them, and the top dog was the one that was guiding the saw along the beam that they're cutting.
Well, we've just re-emerged into something more like the real world, up a track into a housing estate. Amazing place to live, because the kids living around here, that they're 20 yards away, they can find that wonderful, magical place, which is a wood. There's one, look, over behind your head. Yes. Look, you can see how huge it is. What's its wingspan, about 4 feet?
Around about between 5 and 5.5 foot wingspan.
Good Lord. The female... And it's got a forked tail and it's coming right over us. Is that because it might have been reared here?
No, you just happen to be in the core area where all the red kites are, so you're always guaranteed a sighting of at least half a dozen red kites.
And you can see its predatory bill, there's another one above it.
That's an adult, because you can see it's molting. Some of its tail feathers are missing at the moment, so you know that's an adult. The young birds that have just fledged from this year, they look very nice and shiny and fresh because they have all their feathers, you see. But the adults are looking a little bit scrawny and scruffy at the moment because of the lack of feathers.
Well, we've just driven away from the wood and stopped off at a garden centre to have some lunch and met up with Helen Olive, who runs www.redkites.net, Red Kites in the Chilterns. And in the corner of the restaurant is a little television screen showing a video about kites. But in the mating season, there is actually a direct link between the nests in the wood and this television screen. Did it work?
Unfortunately, not this year. The nest failed. However, what we decided to do this year was show a video of 14 red kite chicks in a holding pen that were held there before they were sent to Aberdeen as part of a reintroduction project taking place up in Scotland at the moment.
I think they can't be kept far from here because they're coming back for a good meal, probably of dead squirrels, if John Norris has anything to do with it. The Chilterns area of outstanding natural beauty covers 324 square miles, extending over 4 counties. There are some quite big towns in it, like Luton and High Wycombe, but what people mean by the Chilterns, or associate with the Chilterns, I think, are wooded hills and fields, and that's what I'm looking out on now, standing on the Chilterns Way. And with me are John Taylor from the Chilterns Conservation Society and Richard Boas, who is one of the people responsible for carving out this new circular walk, the Chiltern Way. John Taylor, if I was to get a tube to Amersham, which is the very end of one of the tube lines, could I then enjoy a day walking all the way around here? And how long would it take me to do the works?
You could certainly come to Amersham. A lot of people do, in fact, come to Amersham and have a day or a weekend out in the countryside, in the Chilterns. And you would pick up the Chiltern Way, the village nearby, Coleshill, say, and you could walk to High Wycombe and take the train back home again. Or if you wanted in the other direction, you can take a walk across to Hemel Hempstead, Berkhamsted, and take the train home there again, back into London.
And if you look at the landscape, what would you say the unifying factors are? What are the things that make it particularly Chiltern? Your turn on this one, Richard.
I think the hills and valleys and the woodland in particular. Still, as you can see from this spot here, plenty of woodland in view. The small fields again. Over in the middle distance there, I can see a cricket field. Many of the Chilterns villages have their own cricket teams. And, well, it's just a glorious view, isn't it?
It's a pretty expensive place to live. I mean, it's been described as one of the most desirable places to live in England, if not the most desirable place to live in the countryside. But to have a stake in this, you'd need quite a lot of money, wouldn't you?
It is an expensive area, there's no doubt about that.
But as a place to live, you think it's a good place?
I think it's a wonderful place. I wouldn't live anywhere else.
We've come to a village called North Dean, and I'm on a farm owned by Jill Kent, who has farmed here, I think, for many years.
45 years.
45 years.
Yes.
And have you seen it change much since you came here?
The number of farms in the area has changed enormously. Our farm really was probably 8 farms when we first came, and it's now been amalgamated into one.
Why is it that so many farms have gone?
Because of the unprofitability of farming, basically. It's just uneconomic to farm at the moment. You can't get labour, and as everybody knows, the costs of fuel and energy and everything are rising.
So how have you survived?
With difficulty. No, we actually produce milk to be made into ice cream. We have 2 separate businesses. Our son has the farming business, and our daughter and son-in-law make the ice cream. And so we produce milk for ice cream, which is just slightly more profitable than if it was going on the open market.
If more farms do go in an area around there, what will the impact be on the landscape?
Well, what we're really worried about, because I'm very conservation-minded as well as being a farmer, is that if you don't have grazing animals, you won't have green fields. And the weeds take over, and the climax vegetation in this area is, of course, trees. And in many farms where the livestock have gone, you can see young trees growing up through the grass already.
Isn't the temptation to let your fields to people with horses?
It would be, but because the fields are so steep on most of our farm, horsey people are rather fussy and they like to have flat land for their horses, and not many of them would be willing to put their animals on banks like these.
The other temptation must be to try and sell it for development. Is that impossible? Because are you in a green belt here?
We're in green belt and ANOB, so that is more or less impossible, yes.
But do you find there is a pressure for housing around here? I mean, you're
enormous,
so close to
enormous,
London.
Enormous. I mean, lots of builders would love to be able to buy land from us and build on it, but it's just not possible.
So you've actually retained your farm cottages rather than sell them off?
Yes. With the stock farm, you've got to have a lot of labour to look after the stock properly.
Again, that must be a temptation to say, well, sell the stock, sell the houses and retire.
Well, I can't say it has never crossed our mind, put it that way. It is a temptation, yes, it is. But money is not everything in life, is it? The quality of life is much more important, and that's what we get round here.
That was Open Country, presented by Eleanor Goodman and produced in Birmingham by Helen Leonard. And next week, Helen Mark will be taking a punt on Loch Foyle.